The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Good morning, Long Island, and welcome to DDI on Autism on 103.9 FM, keeping an eye on autism and giving a voice to its Long Island community. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Romas. Again, so glad that you can join us this morning as we share and explore all relevant issues related to autism spectrum disorder. My guest today is Beth Tournis. Beth is the former coordinator of the cochlear implant team at the Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital, Chicago. Currently, Beth works on the cochlear implant team as a part-time senior audiologist. Prior to involvement with cochlear implants, she specialized in auditory evoked potentials and, importantly for our conversation, working with multiply involved hearing impaired children. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I'm so glad to have you here, and thank you for making this this time. Well, you know, why don't we start right at the beginning and let me ask you, what are cochlear implants? What are they?
So basically, they're implantable hearing devices. They're designed for individuals who have a significant hearing loss where hearing aids don't provide enough benefit. So hearing aids aren't able to give the patient, the user, access to speech, which is what we're always looking for. I'm a pediatric audiologist. I work with children. And what we're always looking for is, are we able to get this child able to hear and understand spoken language? So if a hearing aid isn't doing that, it's typically because of the degree of hearing loss. It's so significant that even though we turn the hearing aid up all the way, it's not loud enough. And so the cochlear implant is actually, there's two parts. There's part that's implanted by a surgeon, typically an ENT or an otolaryngologist, sometimes a neuro-otologist that implants the electrode array under the skin. And then there's an external part called a processor that kind of looks like a hearing aid that the patient wears. And you have to have both pieces in order for the device to work. The cochlear implant on the inside basically replaces the little hair cells that are responsible for transmitting auditory signals to the brain. So they basically, when sound comes into the ear, it makes those little hairs move, and then they send a signal to the auditory nerve, and it goes on along up the auditory pathway to the brain. So when you have a really significant hearing loss, those little hairs are either bent or broken so much that even when we put a very loud hearing aid on the ear, we can't shake those little hairs enough to get that signal to transmit properly to the auditory nerve so that the patient can hear and understand. So what the implantable part of the implant does is there's a little electrodes in there, and they basically replace those little hairs. They take the place of those hairs to send that signal onto the brain. You need the outside part because that's where the microphone is that collects the auditory information. And then there's a little mini computer that's also worn on the outside. It's all part of the same device. And it basically changes the information from acoustic energy, how we hear, to electrical impulses. And then that travels across the skin via a little radio transmitter coil. That's held on by a magnet. So if you've ever seen anyone wearing a hearing device with a little like looking magnet or headpiece attached, that's a cochlear implant. And then that radio's coil sends the signal across the skin to those electrodes on the inside. They stimulate the auditory nerve, and then the system kind of works how we hear. It's very different than normal hearing in terms of, you know, it is an electrical signal, so the brain has to adapt to that and make sense of the information. So after the surgery, there is time spent in auditory therapy or training in order for the patient to learn how to make use of that sound. But they're very successful in that most people with cochlear implants are able to detect sounds, so hear soft sounds. Levels very similar with normal hearing individuals. And then in terms of understanding spoken language, most patients are able to understand spoken language, maybe not fully, but to some extent. And so they've been around since the early 1990s now, is when they first got FDA approval in the United States. And so we're still, you know, fairly early on in our medical device career, right? And so there is a lot of kind of research going on in that area. But overall, they're considered a fairly successful device for someone who has a significant hearing loss.
such really such spectacular technology. And you know, as I was listening to you, it seems like it's gone a very long way to replicate what the brain and what the ears do naturally. And it was interesting when you flagged this idea that it doesn't exactly replicate it, more approximates it, but there is that conversion of auditory sound into an electrical impulse. And I'm assuming that the brain is doing a similar conversion, although certainly not exact, but there still has to be that conversion of auditory sound.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So for, again, when they were first designed, it was, they were implanted in adults who maybe had prior hearing and had lost hearing. So they had some auditory experience to draw on. So they knew what things sounded like. So that helps if you give the brain a template as to, you know what a bird chirping is supposed to sound like. So you hear something and you see a bird, you kind of make that association and figure that out. For children or for individuals who haven't had hearing, who are born with a profound hearing loss or significant hearing loss, we have to teach them how to use the devices. So there is that kind of auditory therapy component.
Beth, how old are the children that you work with? How old do the children have to be for it to be effective? Are there some constraints around the age? And also as part of that same question, how does someone become a candidate for this implant, either in childhood or adulthood?
Sure, that's a great question. So the devices are FDA approved down to 1 year of age. So there are children who are implanted even younger for a variety of reasons, but typically it's 1 year. And there are individuals in their 80s and 90s that are receiving the surgery. So there's not an age constraint. One of the things that we look at is kind of what you call duration of deafness. So if you were born deaf and you're 70 years old now and you get a cochlear implant, you've had a really long duration of deafness. And so your ability to make use of that information coming in is not going to be the same as someone who was born deaf and receives a cochlear implant at age one. For all sorts of reasons, neuroplasticity and reorganization of the neural channels and just a variety of things. So for children, we also want them to get the device kind of before that window of learning language closes. So typically that's before age five, but really we really want them to get it under age two is what the literature is showing. 18 months, if they get the device before 18 months, they have a much better chance of becoming an oral communicator. So speaking and understanding spoken language. So duration of deafness is still a thing. So if you're 70 and you lost your hearing last year, you're still a really great candidate because you maybe have a 1 year duration of deafness. Does that make sense?
Oh, it absolutely does. Certainly the idea that there might be there is a physiological substrate around how the brain will process that information and potentially create new pathways at one particular stage as opposed to another.
Right.
I think, right? And I think what's fascinating too, right, just very quickly before we go on to some of the implications for the population of people who are not neurotypical, but I'm just today looking at some articles around how even people who are at a much more advanced age, when they start losing their hearing, that also has very, very real cognitive and neurological impact, both with respect to being separated from the world and then some unfortunate implications around dementia.
Yeah.
And, right? And for the reason, Beth, that you're kind of alluding to, that the idea that stimulus is in present, and with that, the neural pathways aren't really operating the way they should be, or
right.
Could be, let's put it that way. So fascinating stuff, Beth, fascinating. Let me just start that conversation around how this work and how the cochlear implants might benefit all children, but also with a little specificity around children on the spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is definitely near and dear to my heart at the children's hospital I work at. We see a large population of children with autism. And when I first started, I've been working with implants for about 20 years now. And when I first started, we would have families come to us that had been turned away at other facilities because their child was on the spectrum and they weren't able to, they were told they weren't a candidate for the device. And we've really feel strongly that all children deserve to hear. All children, have the potential to hear and connect to the world. And we want to help each child meet their full potential. So it may not, we know that even children who have normal hearing that are on the spectrum may not develop spoken language. So that's not necessarily the goal. The goal is just to get them to their full potential. And one of the things that we found in the work that we did, if you look at like the parent surveys that were returned, is they'll say that kids are more connected to the world around them and more engaged, which of course, especially for children on the spectrum, that's so important to, one of the comments was that it just brought their personality out, that they didn't feel connected to their family at all before.
Yeah, that's exactly. Unfortunately, we have to go to a quick break. I want to start right there, because what could be more central to the challenge of autism and communication, and what could be more central than hearing? So we'll come right back. Stay with us.
Yeah.
DDI on Autism. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Romas. Continue my conversation with Beth Tunis about the very promising subject of cochlear implants on behalf of children, and most especially on behalf of children on the autism spectrum. Yes, Beth, we left off and we were just beginning to talk about some of the special considerations when working with kids on the spectrum. And it does sound, just based on where we're just starting to go, that at the very least there has to be a sensitivity to the nature of that challenge as well.
Yeah, for sure. What's so interesting, when I first started working with implants, the age at which children got cochlear implants was a little bit older. And so a lot of times we would know coming in, okay, this child has autism, and we could have those conversations with the parents beforehand about, our expectations may be different. We want your child to reach their full potential, but that may not be spoken language. It may be more of a connection with their environment, and the ways in which we worked with, those children were maybe a little different, and that we would work with a child that's 3 years old that wasn't autistic. Now we're meeting kids as babies. So I'm frequently seeing kids get implanted at 1 year old. So we don't know that they're going to be on the spectrum until after they've maybe received the device and they're not making the expected progress. And so, kind of stepping back and reassessing and helping the family reassess, where we're going and what we're doing, because there are different considerations when you're working with a child with autism. A lot of them are the same as working with any child in terms of having to figure out how to help someone hear that's nonverbal or that can't give you feedback about what they're hearing or perceiving. But some of it is a little bit different in that we know that, there's a subset of children with autism that are sensitive to sound or loud noises. And we see that with kids with cochlear implants too. There's some sensory concerns about that you do have to wear the device on your head. And sometimes it's a feeling that isn't, is bothersome to individuals with autism. And so kind of having to work around those considerations as well, and not just, the hearing loss. So there is definitely an awareness that a provider needs to have. But it can be really successful. Some of my most successful kids are children with autism. And we do have in our paper that just came out, we actually do have a couple of kids who were, mainstreamed in high school and are oral communicators and graduated high school. So, I think all of our kids are successful. There's a small subset that don't use the cochlear implant for a variety of reasons, but for the most part, some of our kids who I would consider the most successful aren't necessarily the ones who are hearing and speaking, but are the ones who are just able to engage better with their families because they have this device and they're more aware of where sound's coming from or they're more comfortable in their environment.
That makes good sense. I to the extent that we would define success as moving as far as we're able to beyond the baseline, whatever that would be. So that seems like the right direction, move the dial, right? I want to ask you too, Beth, is that even before the decision around a cochlear implant is made, is there something about, whether it's autism or hearing loss, I mean, we're trying to assess that the presence of one or the other obfuscates our ability to diagnose either.
Exactly.
With any certainty. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. So hearing loss is a little bit easier in some ways. We have objective measures that we can use. So we don't rely on, for like in a baby, for example, we're able to diagnose a hearing loss fairly accurately based on putting some auditory signals in their ears and then measuring their EEG response to sound. So we know how that looks in someone with normal hearing, and we know how that it looks in someone with hearing loss. So it is definitely easier in that way to assess that they have a significant hearing loss than it is to determine that they have autism. However, I would agree with you that we definitely have these patients that are very communicatively impaired, and we don't know, is it just the hearing loss, that they have a significant hearing loss that needs help, or is it, you know, something else such as autism spectrum disorder? We don't always know. And so I do think that a lot of times the diagnosis of autism is delayed because, you know, we're attributing maybe the delays in communication to the hearing loss.
Sure. Now, once the person, however old, has the implant, What does the follow-up look like? Is there some kind of, does that person learn how to maximize their benefit from that?
Sure. So there is auditory therapy that takes place. It's called oral habilitation therapy, and it's a speech pathologist typically that provides that service, or sometimes an audiologist who's been trained in helping kids learn to hear and listen, because it's not really speech therapy, it's listening therapy. So teaching them what sound is, and then, you know, hopefully at some point transitioning to helping that child develop or individual develop spoken language. In terms of audiology, my role, we see the child about a month after they've had the surgery to turn the device on. We call it their hearing birthday. Those are the videos you may have seen on Facebook or social media of, you know, baby hears for the first time. And so that's that day. And then I see my patients 9 to 10 times in that first year. We're doing a hearing test in the sound booth. Most of our kids were able to get it again. For someone who is nonverbal and autistic, maybe that hearing test looks different than your, you know, neurotypical 6-year-old who's going to raise their hand when they hear the sound. But we are able, using our kind of pediatric audiology toolkit, to get that hearing test. And then we make adjustments to their device based on what we're seeing in the sound booth. But also there's some objective measures we can do through the implant to figure out where the auditory nerve is responding and where that child should be hearing.
I know it's an emerging research around this issue. It's, as you suggested, it's not all that long ago. The 90s aren't a million years ago, right? So it's growing and it's changing a lot of ways. Are many of the children that you're working with, or some of the children, part of any kind of experimental or research group? Are we following kids longitudinally?
Yeah, so we do have a couple of different research studies going on now, both at our institution and all over, where we do follow kids longitudinally. But the device itself kind of leads to nice retrospective studies as well, because it is a fairly regimented protocol, and our patients do come back at a minimum of annually, and when they're kids, much more often than that. So I think you know, this recent paper that we just did, we did do some surveys, parent surveys in real time, but we also were able to look for the last 10 and a half years at patients that we followed that have autism that use cochlear implants. So that was really nice. We do have a couple of research studies going on right now, but they're mainly on neurotypical children, but looking at language acquisition, looking at you know, how they're hearing, you know, in comparison with their normal hearing peers and developing language and things like that. So,
are there any children or people, you know, is there anyone for whom this would be contraindicated? Is there anyone who said you really should do this?
Yeah, so I think it's two things. The contraindication would be if you don't have an auditory nerve. There's a very small set of individuals with a significant hearing loss that don't have an auditory nerve. And so in those individuals, your outcomes are not expected to be good because there's nothing for the device to communicate with. But it's a small thing. And even in some of those patients, we're still able to do the surgery and have some success. And then, like we were talking about before, if you have a really long duration of deafness, it doesn't mean that you can't get the device and that you can't hear with it. But definitely your expectations would be different. So if you have had a 50-year duration of deafness and want to, you know, be able to understand spoken language, it's not really an appropriate expectation. It's not something that's likely to happen. And so then I would say it's contraindicated just because you're not going to get the outcome that you want.
My understanding is that if you are on the other end of the age group and you're much older, there's quite a waiting list to be even seen for this or eligible. Is that correct? And is there greater access for kids?
I do think that in general, access for kids is, that's a hard question. So in our area, access for kids is definitely, fairly readily available. I can only kind of speak to my Midwest area of the country. There are, a lot of facilities that, do adult cochlear implantation as well. And I don't know about the waiting list, or availability of that. Just like everything else, we were affected by the COVID-19 shutdowns. So cochlear implants are considered an elective surgery. So we weren't able to do surgery for a couple of months. So that definitely made a backlog. And I think just, you know, like every other healthcare facility, we're needing, you know, more staff and employees. And so things are maybe longer than they were in the past. The good news is for an adult, you know, if you had normal hearing and you are losing your hearing, you have a fairly long window of time as to where you can still benefit from the device. So I would say even if it's a long wait list to get in with an cochlear implant facility or an audiologist that could let you know if you're a candidate, it would still be worth the wait.
I have no doubt. I feel like we've really just scratched the surface because it's a relatively new technology. I imagine it has evolved even a little time since the 90s, and it's been changed and advanced. Beth Tunis, I want to bring you back. This is cochlear implants. I hope you'll come back.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to.
Me too. Thank you.
Thank you.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.